The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, can everyone hear okay from me?
Yes.
And, anybody have trouble hearing? Okay. So, what I'd like to do this evening is to describe the kind of meditation that I teach. I've been teaching, as some of you know now, for 25 years. And in some ways, how I've been teaching meditation is pretty consistent. In some ways, it's changed over those years. But it's not so good. Sometimes people don't quite get kind of exactly what I'm teaching because it can sometimes seem a little more vague than some of the very precise techniques that sometimes are taught as vipassana practice, as insight practice. So I'd like to see if I can convey this for you. So the mindfulness practice, that is an ancient practice that goes back to the Buddha, and as it came into the modern era, for the last few centuries, up until about 1880 or so, we have actually very little evidence of there being a lot of meditation done in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and those places. Undoubtedly, there were people and monks who did some meditation, but it seemed to have receded quite far in the background. And it kind of had a, because it was so rare that people meditated, it was often considered to be the domain of sorcerers or people who had magical powers because it was so other. And it might sound kind of strange that Buddhism, which is so strongly identified with meditation, should have a period of time where there wasn't much going on. But, you know, Buddhism had its ups and downs in Asia. And sometimes there were times when it seemed to almost disappear in some countries. In Sri Lanka, at some point, there were so few monks left that they didn't have enough monks to ordain new monks. And you had to have at least five monks to... So there must have been less than five monks left at certain periods in Burmese history. And so they imported monks from... not from Sri Lankan history. And they imported monks from Burma to get the quorum needed to continue there. And then they built, it grew again. And so in the late 1800s, there were a number of people who started getting interested in meditation. And they looked around for what to do. And in different countries, they came up with different little solutions of how to start meditating again or learn it. In Sri Lanka, someone found a manual. And they looked at the manual. And much of the Sri Lankan tradition of meditation had its genesis in, I don't know, the 1880s. Someone found an old manual and it grew from that text. There were other influences as well that came along. In Burma, someone went deep in the woods and found an old monk who was a meditation monk, and they asked him, how do you meditate? And the person said, oh, don't ask me. There's a particular text, ancient discourse by the Buddha, that lays it all out for you. Just study that text. So they went and studied what's called the text called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, text about mindfulness. So again, it kind of, the role of text became very important for the genesis of the modern movement of meditation in our tradition. And then starting there, it started to grow, and there were lots of experimentation, lots of people beginning to meditate and explore it, and developing new ideas, new systems, new things how to do it. And some of them were quite varied from each other. So by the 1960s, Jack Kornfield went to study in Thailand and Burma, and he discovered that there were many forms of mindfulness meditation being taught. And he published a book in the 1970s called Living Buddhist Masters, which is a very interesting study about the teachers who were alive back there and the range of different ways that meditation practice was taught, and even mindfulness practice. And then the book had to be republished some years ago as Living Dharma, that's how it's now, because most of those teachers are now dead. So Living Buddhist Masters didn't work anymore. And so There was one particular strand of two particular strands for this practice of ours that had a big influence on the Western way that teachers like Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg taught this practice. And they came from, one was came from an Indian man named Goenka, who learned the practice in Burma. And the other was a Burmese man named Mahasi Sayadaw. And those two people had very different approaches to how to do the practice. The Goenka approach was very systematic. And one of the key things that he taught was systematically scanning through the body to be mindful of the whole body, but in a very, very precise way. You'd start at the top of your head, then do your forehead, go down through your head, your neck, your shoulders, and your arms, your torso, your legs. And then you do it again, and you get better and better at it, more concentrated at it. You can go through faster and faster. And it's a way of building up a lot of concentration and a very precise, deep attention that begins revealing the world of vipassana. And vipassana is different than mindfulness. Vipassana is the result of strong mindfulness practice. And what vipassana means is insight. Make some sense? I hope you're following this. So the other school of Burmese meditation that had a lot big influence on us here in the West was by a monk named Mahasi Sayadaw. And he came up with kind of his own way. And Mahasi, I didn't study with him, but I studied with one of his disciples. And that was the primary vipassana practice that I learned in Asia, was the Mahasi system. And one of the qualities of the Mahasi system is it is not systematic, like Goenka, you go through systematically, but rather there's a way of practicing mindfulness that is opens up to your full range of experience and lets the full range of your human experience be the subject of mindfulness. So I was very influenced by the Mahasi practice. I came here to the West, back from Asia, and I started hanging around the Western Vipassana teachers, and they had taken it and repackaged it a little bit, the practice of Mahasi, and kind of found a nice way of teaching here in the West. And then as I stayed around the Western for 25, 26, 27 years, and I've been part of the Western insight meditation scene of Spirit Rock, of IMS, I've noticed that the Western teachers have trends in how they teach this practice. And you think that, you go hear a Buddhist teacher and this is the pristine, perfect, unchanging Dharma. This is how it is. But in fact, in Asia and in America, things evolve and change over time. People discover new ways to meditate, new emphasis, new techniques, new things that work for them. And so the same thing here in the last 40 years in America of the tradition that we're part of here at IMC, you can kind of track certain trends of how the practice has been taught. And in fact, there's been changes in how I've taught this practice over the last 25 years. And there's ways that I haven't changed. It's very consistent, and some ways that I've changed. So the way that the primary influence on me for how I teach comes from this tradition called the Mahasi tradition. But then it's been influenced by other factors, and one of the influences on me was my Zen training. And so I brought my Zen training into kind of a little bit to shape or organize or kind of how to hold this so-called Mahasi practice. So I'll talk about that a little bit. So the basic way that I like to teach has four component parts. The first is that it's a practice that's all-inclusive, meaning that our whole range and realm of human experience can be included in the practice. There's nothing which is considered outside of practice. And I explain that sometimes as saying that what makes the practice sacred for me is that there's no outside. Everything can be included within. As soon as you divide the world between what's acceptable and not acceptable, then you lose that sacred dimension of awareness, which is, panoramic, 360 degrees. Everything can be included. So that's the first principle, is a way in which everything is included. Then the question, how is it included? So the second element of the way I like to teach is that there is something called the anchor. It's often called the anchor. the center of gravity, the default, the place where attention goes if nothing else is going on. So there's a place where we develop steadiness, focus, and we can kind of develop and refine our capacity to pay attention and begin seeing more and more deeply into our experience. And the primary place I like to emphasize for doing this is breathing. And in the Zen tradition I practiced in for many years, breathing was the center of gravity, was the focus of meditation. And in the Mahasi practice that I was taught in Burma, breathing was the center of gravity. That was the anchor, the center. And so one of the advantages of having something we kind of begin concentrating on, for many people, it tends to kind of quiet down their mind. It's harder for the mind to be scattered, jumping around. The mind wanders off, and we come back, and we know where we come back to. There's no question about where we're going to go. Just come back. And so there's this... Now, there's other anchors that people use besides breathing. Some people will use the body in various ways, some body sensations, different ways of experiencing the body with the body. Some people, for a long time, found it very helpful to do listening, where sounds became the anchor for the present moment. You just keep going. If nothing else is going on, you just open to sounds and awareness, and that's where you kind of come back to. And there's other things people can use as well. But there's some kind of primary anchor for developing stability and focus. The third element of these four-part elements, so first is all-inclusive, the second is there's an anchor or a center, and the third is that if anything becomes more compelling in your experience, in your present moment experience, then the anchor, then the breathing, that's the anchor, then you would let go of the anchor, let go of focusing on the breath, and bring your attention on that new thing that's compelling. And that new thing becomes the new center, as long as it's compelling. So, compelling, the word that used to be, I was taught, was the word predominant. If something becomes more predominant than the breathing, then that becomes the focus of attention. And so rather than being a technique where you systematically scan through your body, you would, reality tells you where to bring your attention. Because if there's a loud sound that you weren't planning to have, that sound, if it's persistent, tells you to pay attention here because it's compelling. If a strong emotion arises, and that's really compelling, you weren't planning to have the emotion, but there it is. And so lo and behold, it wasn't your plan to have to do emotion meditation today, but reality had a different plan for you. So you get then bring your attention to the emotion, or to thoughts, or whatever is going on, body sensations. And what happens is that in the Goenka tradition, where you systematically scan through the body, it's very effective, and it's kind of a purification process where over time, you kind of address and meet so many different things that we hold in our body. The tensions, the holding, the unresolved issues, the tensions we have. And slowly, slowly, a lot of things begin to dissolve and worked out. It's kind of like getting a massage in a systematic way. In the Mahasi system, it's not done systematically, but it's done not randomly, but we go through the same stuff of purification, of working through things, understanding things. But as reality tells us, pay attention over here. Now's the time for this. The advantage of this way of just being opening to whatever is that over time, hopefully, your whole range of your human experience can be included. And so it becomes, you learn how to practice in every situation you find yourself in. Sometimes when it's a very technique-focused approach to mindfulness, people can get very good at that technique and very concentrated on it, but they don't really know how to apply mindfulness in other areas of their life. So, for example, in my Zen practice, where the focus was primarily on the breathing and posture, I got sometimes good at that, But I didn't really learn much about how to be present for my emotions in a clear, deep way. I didn't learn how to pay attention to how I was interpersonally when I was with other people, this kind of really pay attention. But in the way that this Mahasi practice opens up to the full range of your experience, sooner or later I became aware of my emotions, and I learned to pay attention to it and bring attention to it. The fourth element of how I like to teach it is that as we do this, as we focus on the breathing or we change our attention to something else that's compelling, then you want to keep an easygoing attention on the quality of your mind, on how you are practicing, what the relationship you have to what is you're experiencing. So if you're following your breathing at the center, you want to also notice, how is it you're following the breathing? How are you paying attention to the breathing? Because it could be that you're straining. It could be you're very goal-oriented and really trying to get something. It could be that you're trying to discover something mysterious and mystical in the breath, that these people keep emphasizing the breath is so important. There must be something I'm missing there. And I have to really bore down and find out. And so there's this kind of like anxiety. Or it could be that we're bored about the breath. We're going to do it. We're very dutiful. But we're not really into it. Kind of like, oh, yeah, okay. In breath. Okay. Did that. Out breath. I did that. So some people hear the instructions, stay, follow the breath. And they a little bit have blinders on. And they just focus on the breath itself and not how they pay attention to the breath. So the analogy I like to use for this is, pick up the striker that we use for hitting the bell. And there's two things going on as I hold the striker. There's two things to notice. I can notice the striker, and I can notice the holding of it. Now, if I really think this striker is really important, and it's really my status and as a Dharma teacher depends on this beautiful striker. I mean, every Dharma teacher should have, self-respecting Dharma teachers have a really nice bell striker. And I've had this for many years, and this really, And so this is really important for my identity in front of all of you. And you're looking at this, probably some of you are eyeing it, maybe you won't want it. And so I'm a little bit concerned about you taking my striker. So this striker becomes more and more important, and I hold on to it for dear life really hard. And I'm so concerned with the striker. But if I open my attention to how I hold the striker, I notice that I am clenching it, and it hurts. In fact, it's possible to not even notice how much it hurts because I'm so focused on my obsession with the striker and what it does for my identity. Isn't that great? A lot of concentration there. But if I open up the attention more widely, and notice how I hold it, I say, I don't need to hold it that way. Boy, am I clenching. And as I notice that I'm clenching, then I say, Gil, why are you clenching? Well, because I have this neurotic idea of my identity as a Dharma teacher. And then as soon as I see it, it goes, poof, I don't need that. Wouldn't that be nice? Yes. Thank you. And so the same thing with, you're focusing your attention on the breathing. Some people can be so involved with the breathing, either for or against it or reacting to it, but they think the breath is the point, and they don't notice how they pay attention to the breath. And the idea is to learn how to have a relaxed, soft mind that at the same time is quite focused, that's quite committed, quite engaged, and to have that right balance of being focused and present and be soft and relaxed is an art form of meditation. But it really helps to have both. Because if the mind is too soft and easygoing, then the mind will drift off too much into thoughts and ideas. But if the mind is too focused and tight, that has its problems. You might get a headache. I've gotten headaches from doing meditation that way. So first, the principle of being all-inclusive. Second, the idea of having an anchor, and if it's okay with a person, I recommend breathing. And if that is not okay, then I'll talk to them about other options. And the third one is that if the something else is more compelling than the anchor, then to let go of the anchor and pay attention to that new thing. Until it's no longer compelling, then you come back to the anchor. Or, if you're paying attention to this new thing that's more compelling, and then something else becomes even more compelling, guess what? You go to the even more compelling thing. You go to the most compelling thing. And the advantage of that is that compelling means that's where the attention wants to go most easily. If you don't pay attention to what's compelling, because you think you're supposed to always stay with the breath, for example, then you set up a tension between trying to be with the breath and this thing that's compelling. And so that tension can be deleterious sometimes. So, and then the fourth element is very important. Just periodically, regularly enough, just kind of open up a little bit and say, how am I in relationship to what I'm paying attention to? So maybe an emotion has become compelling and you're horrified. Maybe it's more important to notice that you're horrified than it is to pay attention to the motive, or the resistance you have to it, or the pleasure you get from it. You know, really, this is great, and you're holding on to it. And so there's a lot to notice in the relationship we have to it. As we do this practice, the kind of steadying, calming, settling of the practice, the mind starts becoming less and less distracted, meaning you don't just jump around, get lost in thoughts as much. As we become less lost in thoughts and more present and more kind of keep focusing on the steadiness of mind, concentration, if you will, we start becoming aware of more and more of how we operate, what's going on for us, what's really important here. And many of us live lives which are fragmented, which are obsessed with certain things, and we miss out on a lot of what our full life is about. And so slowly over time, different things show themselves that haven't been attended to or seen before. And one of the places where it's particularly interesting is as the meditation gets calmer and calmer, the mind gets stiller and stiller, we start going through layers and layers in our mind to the more and more subtle operating principles of what makes us tick. And subtle doesn't mean that it's unimportant. It actually becomes more and more important to start seeing what's going on more deeply. But we don't have to go searching for what's deep. In fact, sometimes in our tradition we say, don't go searching for anything. Just be really present for what is and let it show itself to you. And then what's there will begin showing itself more and more clearly. Things will be revealed. Because once you start searching and trying to dig to try to understand, then you no longer have a soft mind. So you want to stay, soft and open, kind of expansive in the mind and consciousness, and then very present for the experience. And over time, and it takes maybe months and years and decades, all kinds of aspects of your life will come parading through. And you get to see so many different things. And one of the analogies that I like to use for this is if you go to the savannas of Africa to be a nature photographer, you could run around the savanna with your camera looking for the animals to take a picture of. Or you can sit at the watering hole and wait for the animals to come there, because all the animals have to come to the watering hole, supposedly, sooner or later. So the watering hole for us is the present moment experience, just staying present for whatever is compelling in the moment, whatever arises in the moment. And sooner or later, all the different issues, all the important things for us to address, all the important things we need to be revealed, will show themselves. And one way I like to emphasize this, to help kind of help people step away from being too self-centered in their practice and think that it's all about being in charge and having a certain experience, is I'd like to say that the Dharma knows better than you what you're supposed to be experiencing. And who knows, one day you sit down to meditate and you're calm, so that's maybe what you're supposed to experience that day. There's lessons of calm. The next day you sit down and you're agitated. And rather than saying, oh no, this is not the day to meditate, obviously, because I'm agitated. You know, yesterday it worked okay. But rather, oh, I guess now today the day to learn how to be present for agitation, to have that to be the focus. And next day you have strong emotions. Next day your neighbor is, doing construction next door and, 4 feet away from your window, banging away. And you say, well, again, I shouldn't be meditating now because this shouldn't be. No, Dharma knows what you need. You need to learn how to meditate now with this hammering next door. Why was this hammering next door having to do with meditation, spirituality, and enlightenment? Why would you want to stay and be present for it? Because as you learn to, if the hammering next door is the predominant experience, don't fight it. Turn your attention and just do listening meditation. In the present moment, there's a sound of hammering going on. Do listening meditation. And then notice what it's like for you to be doing that. Well, how are you relating to it? And you'll find that you hate it. You're impatient. You have a lot of judgments about what meditation is supposed to be like. And you start seeing all these ideas you have that you operate. You notice there's aversion, maybe self-righteousness. How could they? They know this is my meditation time. There can be disappointment. There's a lot of things we began noticing about ourselves. And as we begin noticing and seeing these different aspects of how we operate, we get wise about those areas. And the wisdom that we develop about how we react to the banging next door helps us in our daily life, because the same kind of reactions can happen there, but now we've gotten familiar with it. And we begin to work through it and through it. And so for me, for example, one of my long meditation retreats, I had someone who sat 2 seats away from me on this long retreat, who always came into the meditation hall late. And he had the lumberjack approach to entering meditation hall. It was a wooden floor, and he came banging into the hall. Bam, bam, bam. These wooden floors. And then he would sit down, and I don't know what he had been doing, but for the next 10 minutes he was catching his breath and breathing really heavily. When his breath started to slow down and get calm, then he would take off his Velcro jacket. And so one approach is to, so what do you do? So one meditation approach that some meditations do is just to develop a very strong mind that can override that whole experience, override so you don't hear the sound, so you don't kind of cut through and override the emotional reactions. Get very, very concentrated and focused and enter into kind of a zone, into another kind of state of consciousness. Very nice thing to do. But what that does is you don't really learn about how to be wise about the whole experience. It's kind of like checking out from it rather than turning towards it and learning how to work through it. So it took me a while. But after some weeks, it no longer became a problem for me. It was just sound. It was just banging of, feet on the wood, just sound of breathing. It was sound of Velcro. And it just became like, the sound of the rustle of the wind in the trees. Or it became, background sound that had no issue. Because so much of the reason why it was a problem for me did not stem from the sound, but was my reaction, response, judgment of the sound. So rather than getting concentrated and overriding it, and rather than writing a letter to the director of the center saying you have to, do something of this person, I steadily and slowly got, was present for the experience, and as I got present for it, I got to see what my reactions and responses were, and got to work through them until they settled out, they let go of what was not necessary, and it just became present for this sound in an easy way. So if you sit down to meditate and that day you're agitated, You get to do the same thing with agitation. You have judgments about agitation, resistance to it. You might have all kinds of push and pulls around it and ideas. And one of the things we're trying to learn is to be, if you're agitated, to be agitated and nothing else. Just simple. Just simple agitation. Not agitated because you're agitated. Not disappointed because you're agitated. Not, you know, angry at the person who gave you too much coffee that day. You know, just now you're agitated and you learn how to be at peace with that. So this all-inclusive approach is learning how to be at peace with whatever comes your way that reality gives you, whatever the experience might be. And then as we learn to do this in meditation, the meditation gets quieter and quieter, more and more still, because the mental chatter, the mental agitation, the mental activities are no longer needed anymore. And we've kind of understood, we get wise about how it works. So for example, you sit and meditate, maybe on the breath, and your mind starts to think. And when it's at some point you get wise enough about thinking that you're right there and you notice the mind begins to think, and you don't have to even let go of the thinking. All you have to do is let it be. Just kind of like let the mind be free. Let the mind be relaxed. Let the mind be open. And the thinking goes away. It's not because you're letting go of it, but because you're just free of it. And there's a little bit of a kind of very subtle little movement in the mind of letting it be. Just, I'm not going there. I'm not picking it up. I'm not getting involved. Right there, noticing it. And but you've learned that skill because you're not getting into some deep concentration state that overrides things, but you've learned how to meet the world of thinking and become wise about it and learn how it works and learn how you work in relationship to thinking, how you relate to thoughts, how you hold on to them, how you resist them, how you get interested in them. And you learn a different way of using the mind. And as you become freer and freer, you learn a freer and freer way to hold your awareness and hold your mind. The mind, the quality of the mind, becomes more peaceful or more fresh, more transparent, more empty. There's a very special word in Buddhism, the word empty or emptiness, more empty. But one of the most important things we're learning is how to be present for what is as it is. And then we don't have to have preferences. We don't have to kind of be at war with how what things are or prefer it to be differently. We discover some very special way to be present for things as they are. So when I first started teaching 25 years ago, when I was still very much kind of coming out of my Zen background, I emphasized very much the value of being mindful in the moment for itself. That there was no need to have a goal. In fact, to have any kind of goal for the practice was a kind of separated you from the present moment. You're kind of a little bit thinking ahead into the future rather than being fully present here. And there's something very, very satisfying and very profound about learning to be fully present for this experience you're having now, whatever it is, as if it's, in Zen they said, as if it was, it's perfect in itself, as if this is it. It doesn't have to be any way different. So we're not judging, we're not pushing, we're not manipulating, we're not fixing, just fully present for this experience. It's a powerful thing to do. And it can teach you a deep satisfaction of just being alive in a very simple way. Just this. One of the most one of the very significant thing my Zen teacher told me, it's a kind of offhand remark one day. He said to me, just to be alive is enough. Just to be present now is enough. If it's not enough just to breathe and be present in a peaceful way now, chances are there's some mental activity, some relationship, some attitude, some reactivity, some judgment that's getting in the way of being at peace right now. So then if that, as the mind gets quieter, we start noticing those reactions and those thoughts and working through them. So that was my emphasis when I first started teaching. But what I noticed is that as I taught this way, kind of just be present for things as they are right now, a lot of people were kind of complacent about the practice. They just kind of, oh, there's nothing really to attain. We just kind of hear in a relaxed way. It's very nice. And they just kind of cruised along. And I thought, well, that's not the practice either. And so now what's happened slowly over time, now I tend to teach a little bit more goal-oriented. Yes, if you do this practice well or thoroughly, really give yourself to it, not complacently, the mind will develop concentration, will develop stronger mindfulness, greater stillness. And there is some powerful and significant experiences that can happen, insights that can happen, if you hang in there and keep doing it. It is onward leading into deeper and deeper, or higher and higher, whatever your metaphor you like, realms of our mind, of our hearts, of consciousness, of reality, up until the point of realization, of enlightenment that can happen. And so for people to have that vision that this is possible, then there's some people then, yet this, I want to give myself more to this. It's not just about being, stress reduction in daily life and just being okay with things and accepting things as they are. There are some place to go here. So what I hope to convey in what I teach is actually not one or the other of those two approaches, but hold both approaches together. That it's really helpful in this practice to learn how to be fully present for the breath, for your emotions, for your life as it is, as it's happening, as if that's enough, but really fully there. And at the same time, to know that it's onward leading. It leads to something. There are potential and possibilities we can grow into if we do that. And that can be inspiring. And it not only can be inspiring, but it can speak to something that sometimes we intuitively know. There can be an intuitive knowing, a sense, oh, there's more here. There's a possibility. There's freedom. There's depth. There's a greater sense of being at home. Different people have different language for it, but there's sometimes a yearning, a call for something, and there's a sense of a possibility. Yes, there is. And if we only say, don't have a goal, just be present, then sometimes we're dismissive of this deep inner intuitive, yes, there's something more. But if we only emphasize there's something more, a lot of people have crashed and burned. And they overshoot the practice. They overshoot the present moment. So the art, what I like to teach, what I try to do, and I don't think I'm that good at it, but is to try to kind of do the balance of these two. We hold both together, practicing kind of just for the sake of really being here in the present moment, but being inspired and being directed and being somehow leaning into some of the deeper potential this practice has to offer. So our practice is all-inclusive. Nothing is left out. I think learning to do that, we become a gift to our society as we learn to have more and more inclusive society. And as our consciousness, our awareness can include everything, then our hearts hopefully can include everyone we meet. And then have a center. I called it an anchor today. Other days I've called it the home base for awareness. Have the breathing to be your home. If nothing else is compelling, stay there and develop the practice there. But then if something else is more compelling, then an easy, relaxed way, let go of the breath and take in that experience of what's compelling. And then as you do the breath meditation, as you do the compelling experience meditation, then periodically in an easygoing way, check in with yourself. And what is your relationship to what you're paying attention to? What's going on in your mind? what's the quality of your mind as you do this, and see if you can kind of adjust it to make it a little bit softer or relaxed or sharper or clearer, whatever's needed in the moment to come into balance. And as these kind of simple principles are practiced over time, it becomes kind of like someone who's maybe an athlete, like a swimmer. Swimmer has strokes, they do, in the water. And the strokes are pretty simple, you know. Just lift your hand over the water, over your head, and put it back in the water and push through, you know. It's pretty simple and straightforward. But as a masterful swimmer keeps practicing month after month, year after year, more and more subtlety in that stroke becomes evident. And they're ever more refined and more refined, more refined what they do. And it becomes elegant, beautiful to watch what they do. So as we do this meditation practice over and over again, all the, you know, we start working through in subtleties and the grossness and all the different things that we get, seeing ourselves in so many different ways. And so this meditation practice starts taking many different shapes and goes many different directions. Sometimes certain things get emphasized. We might spend a long time on the body, just our physical experience. Other times we might spend a lot of time on our emotions. Other times we might spend a lot of time on what's going on in our mind, the quality of our mind. Different things become kind of the emphasis at different times. Different things are different, and we learn that different things support different people. There might be certain ways that meditation, this practice of mindfulness, really works well for you that's slightly different than how I teach you or someone else teaches it. And over time, we start finding our own way and what helps us to be free, present, peaceful, still, quiet, whatever you're trying to do. And one other last thing I'll say, that one of the wonderful things to do, and one of the things that's very gratifying for me as a teacher, is when people learn some of the basic principles of mindfulness in the practice, and learn about having a higher quality mind, heart, from meditation practice, and then they realize, they want, why do I only have this in my meditation? Why don't I do this too for my daily life? And then they make it to practice to start bringing this practice into daily life. And you know, paying attention to the present moment and understanding themselves and learning how to open the awareness up. Inclusive awareness, relaxed awareness, soft awareness, present moment awareness as we go through our lives. And that's a very different way of living our lives than the ways many people live, which are often burdened with a lot of stress, a lot of contraction, a lot of agitation. And so to bring that into our life, our relationship to others, is one of our gifts that this practice can give the world. So I hope that this explanation made enough sense for you and gives some clarity to what I teach here. If it is not clear, if it seemed too complicated or something, then you're welcome to leave what I said here today and not take it with you. Thank you all.